All right. Good evening, everyone. Good that you're having a good week, as always. And we're going to get into our study of Exodus tonight. We talk about our chapter reviews here. And remember, we don't have to go all the way back to the beginning. We'll start in chapter 19. What's the significant thing that happens in chapter 19? Yeah, they finally arrive at Mount Sinai. And what about chapter 20? All right, Ten Commandments. Good. And 21 and 22 are a little more difficult. I'd be impressed if you remembered it without writing it down. That'd be impressive. But anybody know 21? Good, yeah. Personal injuries. Good. We should, think of that in our society, that we have personal injury lawyers, everywhere. Maybe that'll help us remember that. And then 22 is property rights. And then 23... and then chapter 23, there's something God promises to them at the very end. Yeah, conquest of the land of Canaan. Because remember, the entire book of the covenant is tied directly to that physical land. And so God says, look, I'm going to give it to you, just like I promised I would. So 23 is conquest promise. Now we come tonight to chapter 24, where the covenant is ratified or agreed on, made official, in other words. When we finished the last class, Moses was still up on Mount Sinai at the end of chapter 23, receiving all the instructions for the book of the law. Well, in chapter 24, he comes down from Mount Sinai to make the covenant official with the people. So that's where we're going to start as soon as we say a prayer. Father in heaven, thank you so much for the week that you've blessed us with so far, the good health that we've had and the opportunity we've had to live and breathe and move on this earth and give you praise, give you all glory. We pray that we have been pleasing to you in all that we've done, and we're grateful for this midweek recharge, or that if we've been discouraged or it's been difficult being in the world this week, that we can come together as a family and encourage and boost each other's faith and boost each other's hope and love, and stir one another up to love and good works as we worship together, as we study your word together. Bless us as we dig in further to Exodus tonight. We pray all these things in Jesus' name. Amen. All right, so the word ratified is a little strange, but think of it this way. You know, when you make a deal with someone in our culture today, often it's very typical that you'll both discuss the terms of the deal. But after you discuss the terms of the deal, is the deal really official yet? Just because you discussed the terms? No. Something has to be done. What do we typically do in our culture to make a deal official? Maybe a couple things. All right, yes. You sign, right? You put your signature on paper. That shows, hey, this is a deal, this is an agreement. And if it's less formal and there's no paperwork involved, what do? You shake on it. Right? You're ratifying a covenant. Now, what we'll learn in chapter 24 is their means of ratifying a covenant is way different. It's not a handshake. It's not a signing on a dotted line. And we'll talk about that. But that's what is really going on here. God has just spoken the terms of the agreement to Moses on Mount Sinai. And now they're gonna say, okay, let's do this. Let's make this covenant official. So let's read verses 1 and 2 in chapter 24, just to start. I want to make a couple observations about these first two verses. Then God said to Moses, come up to Yahweh, you and Aaron, Nadab and Abihu, and 70 of the elders of Israel, and you shall worship at a distance. Moses alone, however, shall come near to the Lord, but they shall not come near, nor shall the people come up with him. So it seems like Moses is still on Mount Sinai here. And he's been told all the laws, and God is telling Moses what to do the next time he comes back up. So after Moses goes down, God's saying, this is what you're going to do the next time you approach me. And this actually happens in verse 9. So if you skip down to verse 9, it says, then Moses went up with Aaron, Nadab, and Abihu, and 70 of the elders of Israel. So he actually did this in verse 9. But before that happens, we read in verses 3 through 8 about the ratification of this covenant. Question, were they all going to come near to God on the mountain? No, only one, only Moses would. But what do you think is significant about the fact that God allows Aaron and his sons, Nadab and Abihu, to go up with Moses on Mount Sinai? Jason?
Well, Aaron already had kind of a position of leadership in conjunction with Moses, and obviously Aaron and his descendants are going to ultimately become the priesthood of God. They are going to be there.
Yeah.
Between the people.
Good. Yeah, God is really establishing already a pattern for the priesthood, because the priests to come will be from Aaron's family. So he's already setting up this precedent for certain people who can approach God more than others. Moses can go all the way to God. The priests can come a little bit closer. And then the elders, they can come a little bit closer. But then you have all the rest of the Israelites. They're just down at the foot of the mountain. And they can't come close. Here's what I want you to see. Mount Sinai is actually a foreshadowing of the tabernacle that God is about to give them instructions to build in the next six chapters. From 25 to 31. You see some parallels there. God's presence is in the form of a cloud on top of Mount Sinai. Likewise, when they build the tabernacle, God's presence will be there in the form of a cloud in the most holy place. Just like there's only one person who can enter God's presence on the top of Mount Sinai, so too there will only be one person who can enter God's presence in the tabernacle. And that's who?
High priest.
Yeah, the high priest, right? Which the first high priest will be Aaron. Okay, but yeah, only the high priest. And then you see that Nadab and Abihu get to come a little bit closer than everybody else can, because they're the priests. And it's the same way in the tabernacle. The priests can enter into the holy place, but they can't enter into the most holy place. That's only the high priest. But they can come closer than everybody else. Everybody else has to stay outside.
The high priest only once.
Yeah, good. Only once a year the high priest can enter. So very, very restrictive, even for the high priest. So, in a subtle way, Moses is connecting Exodus 24 to the section that follows, in 25 to 31, about the tabernacle. Think about it this way. The tabernacle will be like a portable Mount Sinai. The vertical, this, remember, God is teaching his people about their relationship using space and distance. So this vertical mountain with all these boundaries and restrictions, that vertical mountain represents God's relationship with his people and how, because of sin and his holiness, they can only come so close. Well, the tabernacle is going to be a horizontal version of the vertical mountain of Sinai. But it's all kind of teaching his people these same concepts about his holiness and his presence and how he can be approached. Any comments or questions through verse 2? We'll get into the ratification section in a moment. Any comments about that or questions? No, David.
In verse 7 there are 24, it says that he took the covenant. Does that mean that those chapters like a 22 and 23 and the Ten Commandments on 20, that he wrote those down and then he read them out to the
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, and that's why we typically will call chapters 20 through 23 the Book of the Covenant, because that's what Moses writes down, and that's what he's going to read to them in verse 7. Yeah, absolutely. Good question. And let's read about that now. Okay, let's just read verses 3 through 8. Then Moses came and recounted to the people all the words of Yahweh and all the ordinances. And all the people answered with one voice and said, "All the words which Yahweh has spoken we will do." Moses wrote down all the words of the Lord. Then he arose early in the morning and built an altar at the foot of the mountain with 12 pillars for the 12 tribes of Israel. He sent young men of the sons of Israel, and they offered burnt offerings and sacrificed young bulls as peace offerings to the Lord. Moses took half of the blood and put it in basins, and the other half of the blood he sprinkled on the altar. And then he took the Book of the Covenant and read it in the hearing of the people, and they said, "All that the Lord has spoken we will do, and we will be obedient." So Moses took the blood and sprinkled it on the people, and said, "Behold, the blood of the covenant which the Lord has made with you in accordance with all these words." Let's just continue down to verse 11. "Then Moses went up with Aaron, Nadab and Abihu, and 70 of the elders of Israel. And they saw the God of Israel, and under his feet there appeared to be a pavement of sapphire as clear as the sky itself. Yet he did not stretch out his hand against the nobles of the sons of Israel. And they saw God, and they ate, and they drank." So Moses first comes down the mountain and speaks verbally to them all the things in the Book of the Covenant, essentially, all the things that God told him from chapters 20 through 23. And after verbally telling them those laws, they said, "Sounds great. We'll do it. We'll do all of those things." And then, as David mentions, he writes those things down, and he calls it the Book of the Covenant. And after writing them down and going through these sacrifices, he reads all the words again. And then they say the same thing. "All that you have said, we will do." And in fact, that makes three times now in Exodus that they have said that, because they said it earlier in chapter 19. And I think the text is emphasizing over and over again that the people understood what God expected of them. It's not like they were confused about the terms. They heard them twice here. And yet they still say, "Yeah, absolutely, I'm going to do this." They have great intentions. They want to serve God. They make this huge commitment, which is only going to make their later rebellion that much more tragic. Question: what do they do to ratify this covenant? What are some things they do? We shake hands. What did they do?
Offerings.
Okay, yeah, offerings. A couple different kind of offerings. You had the burnt offering, and you had the peace offering. And then they also sprinkled blood from those offerings on the altar and on the people. Moses sprinkled it on the people. And then it seems that the leaders eat a meal in God's presence later in verse 11. Now let's kind of take these one by one and talk about the significance of each of these things. We'll learn later that burnt offerings had to do with atonement for sin, but it also symbolized total dedication to God. And that's because the burnt offerings had to be completely given to God. Some of the other offerings, if you offered it as a worshiper, not only did the priest get to eat some of it, but you got to eat some of it. But not with burnt offerings. You couldn't eat any of that. It was all given to God. And so it was symbolic of dedication, saying, "Look, we're giving ourselves fully to you, O Lord." And in the process, you know, that sacrifice also would have provided forgiveness as well. The peace offerings, these were like free will offerings given basically to celebrate that things were right with you and God. You know, the burnt offering, "Hey, I need some atonement, and I want to show you my dedication." The peace offering wasn't for atonement. It was just a free will thing that you gave out of joy, basically, that I'm right with God, that I have fellowship with Him.
Was it reaffirming?
Yeah, I think so. I think it was reaffirming.
For the future, I'm going to try again for the future.
But try again?
To obey God, to
okay.
Keep my covenant.
Okay, good, yeah. Probably has to do with some reaffirmation of your commitment to God, and I love that we have fellowship together, and I'm going to keep it this way, essentially. I'm sure, that's a good point. Some of that was going on. And with the peace offerings, some of the worshipers got to eat some of that sacrifice. And that'll be significant in the fourth point there. Because, I'll come back to the sprinkled blood. Let's talk about the eating a meal in God's presence. Eating together was a common way that people ratified a covenant. You see that several times in the book of Genesis, where, you know, Abraham, Isaac, or Jacob, you know, would make a covenant with somebody and then they would eat together. This was a way to symbolize this fellowship, and now we're in agreement, and now we're in this relationship, and everything is good. Interestingly, whenever they sacrificed an animal on the altar, it was like they were giving God food. Okay? And I say that symbolically, because God doesn't need to eat, right? God doesn't need our food. But Leviticus chapter 3 and verse 16, if you'll just look there real quick, Leviticus 3:16, I just want to show you, I'm getting this from the Bible, I'm not just saying this because it sounds good. Leviticus 3:16 talking about, this whole chapter in Leviticus 3 is all about the peace offering. And he says in Leviticus 3:16, the priest shall offer them up in smoke on the altar as food, an offering by fire for a soothing aroma. All the fat is the Lord's. Okay, so yes, God doesn't have to eat, okay, but symbolically it's like, hey, you know, this is your, we're giving you what you need from us, God. But the reason that's significant, especially in this Exodus 24 context, is while God is eating from the sacrifice, they too are going to get to eat a portion of that sacrifice. And so they're sharing a meal together, symbolically with God on the mountain. And that shows, hey, we're in covenant with each other. And we're in this great relationship with each other. That's some of the symbolism that's going on there. And then the sprinkling of the blood, well, this sort of really symbolized the atonement from sin. Because they're offering the sacrifice, the burnt offering, and I'm sure part of that blood, you know, was used to sprinkle on the altar, representing that really they're being atoned for by this animal. And sprinkling it on the people would probably symbolically mean, look, the people are covered. Their sins are covered by this animal. And so I'm physically sprinkling, I'm physically covering you in this blood to represent the fact that you're covered spiritually by this blood. And it's this blood that allows you to enter into the covenant, which is why Moses calls the blood of the covenant. Because it's only by the shedding of that animal blood that this covenant is even possible. And again, that sounds kind of, you know, strange to our ears living in modern day America today. But again, it's all this very important lessons God is trying to teach them about substitution for their sin. That yes, death is the penalty for sin, but because of my mercy, I'm going to allow an animal to die instead. And because this animal has died, now you can be viewed as my people. And we can have this covenant relationship. Bill?
It kind of speaks to what's going to happen later on, doesn't it?
Good, yeah.
With the blood and the effect that it has on the folks in the New Testament.
Great, and that's actually my next question, because this is loaded with New Testament foreshadowing. And I was just going to say, how so? And Bill mentioned New Testament. Go ahead, Jack.
Yeah, without the shedding of blood, there is no forgiveness.
Okay, yeah, Hebrews 9:22 says that. Without the shedding of blood, there really can be no forgiveness.
And what did Christ say? He said, this is the new covenant in my blood, or my blood in the new covenant. Sorry, I get the...
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, Herb's referring to Matthew 26, and of course it's in all the Gospels about the... or at least the synoptics.
But that language is identical to what Moses said.
It is. Yeah. Jesus says, take drink when he institutes the Lord's Supper. He says, take drink. This is my blood of the new covenant, which is shed for the forgiveness of sins. Right? So,
a direct reference to what Moses did.
Yeah, absolutely. And how about other things? Any other ideas about New Testament fulfillment there? How about, let's stay on that. Let's stay on the Lord's Supper. Any parallels there?
Well, we're told to eat of the bread.
All right.
Which represents the body of Christ.
Exactly.
They were eating of the body which was sacrificed.
Yes.
We're eating symbolically of a body that was sacrificed.
Yes. Perfect. Yeah, we're getting, just like they got to partake of the peace offering, the offering that was made for their peace between God, we too get to partake of the peace offering. But the offering was Jesus. Mm-hmm. And we're symbolically partaking of his body in the Lord's Supper that was given for us. Absolutely. Anything about, what do you think about the burnt offering? So Jesus' sacrifice, we could say, was a peace offering that brought peace between us and God. How about a burnt offering?
Well, sure, the world
doesn't
know where you're going, right?
All right, that's fine. That's fine.
Talks about his being an offering for sin.
Yes, he's both.
He's both.
Because think about it this way. The burnt offering was the offering that nobody got to partake of. It was wholly devoted to God. Entirely dedicated to God. And that's exactly what Jesus was. In fact, I think that's the point the Hebrew writer makes in Hebrews 10, where he quotes from Psalm 40, and he says, look, a body, or he says, burnt offerings you have not desired, but a body you have given me. I have come, O Lord, to do your will. And so Jesus fulfills that in the ultimate way, being a burnt offering, literally giving all of himself in service and dedication to God, which also, by the way, provides atonement for all the people at the same time. So, yeah, I think that's a lot of really good symbolism there.
Instead of being sprinkled, we're immersed in his blood.
Okay. Actually, literally, you can make that connection to sprinkling too, because look in Hebrews 10. Look in Hebrews 10.
Your heart sprinkled from the evil
time. Yeah, exactly. Good. So Hebrews 10, since I should have just had you turn there already, since I quoted it earlier. So let's just back up so I can give you the quote in Hebrews 10. Look in verse 5. This is my point about the burnt offering. Therefore, when he comes into the world, Hebrews 10:5, he says, sacrifice and offering you have not desired, but a body you have prepared for me. In whole burnt offerings and sacrifices for sin, you have taken no pleasure. But then I said, behold, I have come. In the scroll of the book it is written in thee, to do your will, O God. So he's saying, look, God doesn't take a pleasure really in burnt offerings of animals. I mean, that really doesn't do anything. But what he does want is the dedication of our hearts to him and our entire lives to him. And Jesus does that. And by doing that, he provides atonement. And then down in verse 22, which I think is what Jack was quoting, he says, let us draw near with a sincere heart in full assurance of faith, having our hearts sprinkled clean from an evil conscience and our bodies washed with pure water.
Yeah, your verse is better, but mine is 9:14. How much more shall the blood of Christ, who through the eternal Spirit offered himself without spot to God, purge your conscience from dead works?
Okay, good.
The living God.
Good.
That's when we come in contact with the cleansing power of God.
Good, yeah, absolutely. And I'll just add one more in the mix because it just has the wording so much more literally. 1 Peter 1 and verse 2, he's addressing these Christians. He says in 1 Peter 1 and verse 2, according to the foreknowledge of God the Father, by the sanctifying work of the Spirit, to obey Jesus Christ and be sprinkled with his blood. May grace and peace be yours in the fullest measure. So he does make this point that we as Christians have been sprinkled by Jesus' blood. Even Isaiah 53, in the suffering servant passage, it says that he will come and sprinkle many nations. And it's probably a reference to this idea of sprinkling with his blood to cleanse. So just so much rich foreshadowing going on. And I'll just say this last thing. Because Jesus' sacrifice is so much better than the sacrifice of animals, it means that now under the new covenant, we don't have to worship God at a distance like they did anymore. We can actually all draw near, as Hebrews 10:22 says. We can all draw near to God with the full assurance of faith. And, you know, we can have that access like Moses did to God, not at a physical mountain, but spiritually. We can just enter God's throne room with confidence because of our cleansed conscience from sin and that beautiful sacrifice of Christ.
And because Christ was our prophet, priest, and king, he was the one that died for us.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, very good. So just wanted you all to see the richness of what's going on there in that text in teaching people about Jesus. The whole Old Testament is about Jesus, ultimately. And it's fulfilled in him perfectly. Debbie, and then we'll get to the next section.
Well, I have a question about the next scripture that said that verse 9,
okay.
Exodus 24:9,
uh-huh.
that Moses and Aaron and Nadab and Abihu and 7 went up and saw the God of Israel. Mm-hmm. And then in verse 11, so God did not raise his hand against these leaders. They saw God. Yeah. And I thought the Bible said that no man has ever looked upon the face of God and lived.
That's true. I think the Bible, yeah, the Bible uses that language, they saw God, in several different places, and it doesn't really mean they literally saw him in all of his glory. Because you're right, there is a passage that says you can't see God and live. So here, it almost seems like they really are just seeing his feet. I mean, they look up and they see this pavement of sapphire, which is a beautiful blue color, and they see the feet of God. But I don't get the picture. They're seeing his full glory here. Even Moses later, God's just going to show him his back. So there is a limited way in which they're seeing him. I don't think the point of that is they literally saw God in all of his glory, but some sort of manifestation of God, I think, is a fair way to look at that. We gotta keep moving. That's a great question. Verses 12 through 18 in chapter 24, Moses reascends Mount Sinai. Here Moses goes back up to Mount Sinai to receive the Ten Commandments on stone and to receive all the instructions about the tabernacle that is going to follow in chapters 25 through 31. But before Moses goes up, he puts Aaron and Hur in charge. And then he goes up the mountain for 40 days and 40 nights. Now, again, while he's up there on this mountain, he's going to receive everything from chapters 25 to 31, but we're going to skip those chapters for now and go straight to chapter 32 so that we can draw a sharp contrast between their excitement and devotion to the covenant here in 24 and see what happens in 32. So at the very end of chapter 24, it says Moses entered the midst of the cloud as he went up to the mountain, and Moses was on the mountain 40 days and 40 nights. And then you pick up in chapter 32, and it's like it doesn't skip a beat. And it says, now when the people saw that Moses delayed to come down from the mountain, and here we're going to read, essentially, that the Israelites break the covenant that they just made with God in chapter 24. So let's read about this. Verse 1, when the people saw, and we'll just go down to verse 10. That's all we'll cover tonight. Now when the people saw that Moses delayed to come down from the mountain, the people assembled about Aaron and said to him, come, make us a god who will go before us. As for this Moses, the man who brought us up from the land of Egypt, we do not know what has become of him. And Aaron said to them, tear off the gold rings which are in the ears of your wives, your sons, your daughters, bring them to me. And all the people tore off the gold rings which were in their ears and brought them to Aaron. He took this from their hand and fashioned it with a graving tool and made it into a molten calf. And they said, this is your god, O Israel, who brought you up from the land of Egypt. Now when Aaron saw this, he built an altar before it, and Aaron made a proclamation and said, tomorrow shall be a feast to Yahweh. So the next day they rose early and offered burnt offerings and brought peace offerings, and the people sat down to eat and drink and rose up to play. Then the Lord spoke to Moses, go down at once, for your people whom you brought up from the land of Egypt have corrupted themselves. They have quickly turned aside from the way in which I commanded them. They have made for themselves a molten calf and have worshipped it and have sacrificed to it and said, this is your God, O Israel, who brought you up from the land of Israel. And the Lord said to Moses, I have seen this people, and behold, they are an obstinate people. Now then, let me alone that my anger may burn against them and that I may destroy them, and I will make of you a great nation. You know, when we read this, it's kind of hard to believe our ears. Yeah, how in the world is this possible? So quickly after agreeing to this covenant, just 40 days prior, they all said, everything Yahweh said, we're going to do it. Absolutely. Sign us up for this covenant.
Yet three times they said that.
Yeah, three times they said it. And yet here, they're committing idolatry and being led into that by Aaron, who was just put in charge by Moses before Moses went up on the mountain. So let's talk about maybe what are some causes behind this? What is going on here that would drive them to do this? John?
Well, their leader has been gone for 40 days and 40 nights. So probably after 10 or 12 days, some people are starting to get worried. After about 20 or 30 days, some people are starting to freak out.
Okay. All right. I think so.
They just came out of a base of basically a pagan civilization. Mm-hmm. For how many?
Yeah, 400 years, yeah.
400, exact. So yeah. They were just thinking, what do we do? What do we do? So
right.
They're freaking out. So they're going, why don't we make something for God?
Yeah.
They probably thought they were doing right.
Yeah, I think
so. You know, what we read about God is going, oh, Moses, you better get down there quick. They're screwing up that. Mm-hmm. All right. If they're gone that far, they went right back to it, get back down there.
Yeah. Yeah. So you bring up a couple points.
The other thing is, it's like Herb said, they said that three times. We were going to do it. How many times have we said that?
Yeah.
I'm not going to do that again.
Okay. Yeah, sure. So there's an application there. Yeah, so let's talk about that. So John mentions, you know, they're kind of panicking. And I think, to their credit, if you're the Israelites and you're used to Moses going up, you know, Moses has been up and down the mountain like three or four times by this point. And if you're kind of used to him going up the mountain, maybe for only a few days, and then returning after a few days, well, now he's gone for 40. That's kind of a long time to wait. I mean, yeah, from the grand scheme of history, 40 days is nothing. But if you're living in it, that's over a month, right? A month and 10 days. I mean, that's a long time compared to all the other times Moses was back kind of quickly. So they're kind of wondering what happened to him. They say, look, we don't even know what's become of this Moses. Maybe they thought he died. You know, hey, look, you spend that long in the presence of God, maybe he just died.
Or
I don't know.
Maybe God killed him.
Yeah, maybe God killed him. Maybe he did something wrong. Maybe Moses abandoned us, right? And he's not the leader we thought he was. Okay, they're impatient, essentially. They don't want to wait any longer. They want to do what they want to do right now. Jason, go ahead.
I think what John's point is that here's both were in the people, but remember they had just heard God's voice, and that scared them so much that they were like, you go talk to him. We're gonna go somewhere else. But they're still seeing the presence of God covering the mountain in what was surely a terrifying scene. And so, as you say, the longer Moses is gone, the more they're thinking, well, maybe he just didn't survive this. And then, of course,
maybe so.
Aaron was left in charge, and he's got a million people who are very scared, very upset, and they want something else to happen. And so Aaron probably also acting out of fear and not a little bit of stupidity, in my opinion, because you mold a golden calf and say, here is Yahweh, right after God said,
sure,
don't worship things you make.
Yeah, exactly.
But I think fear and uncertainty, it drove that. And a little bit of time in a scary situation can seem a lot longer. So it was only 40 days in the grand scheme of things. But with all of the intensity surrounding their circumstances, they lost faith.
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, the point is not to, you know, excuse the Israelites or anything, but we're just trying to relate to them and say, look, if you're there, and as Jason said, yeah, they're on this mountain and this is terrifying and it's been 40 days, yeah, they don't really know what to think at this point. So probably some of it is impatience. Some of it could have to do with doubt about Moses. All throughout the wilderness wanderings, people question Moses' leadership. That may have been led by some of the non-Israelites that came out of Egypt with them, but they'll later grumble and complain about Moses being in charge. And you see some of that contempt here, because they say, as for this Moses, and, you know, scholars say in Hebrew, I mean, that's kind of a derisive way to say something. As for this guy, you know, as for this Moses, we don't know what's happened to him. So it's almost like they're upset at Moses for taking so long. It's not just that they're impatient, they're mad at Moses for making them wait. And they may be questioning whether he has their best interests at heart or not. In fact, this is probably why they go to Aaron, because they're trying to say, you know, you be our leader now, because we don't know what his deal is. He's been gone for way too long. You need to take over, Aaron. Hang on one second, Chloe. And then John also said, this is what they're used to in Egypt. Right? They've been in Egypt for 400 years. And in the ancient Near Eastern world, it was very common to make a physical representation of your God that you serve. So instead of taking their cues from God and Moses, they're taking their cues from the pagan world that they've grown up in. So it's not a stretch of the imagination to see, like, okay, where did they get this from? Well, they're used to that. But ultimately, at the heart of it, it's unbelief. Unbelief that God is to be obeyed. Because they're breaking God's law here. They're breaking the second commandment. He said, don't make idols. They're not really breaking the first commandment. Right? They're not really making another God. They're saying this is Yahweh. This is just the physical representation of Yahweh who took us out of Egypt. That's so important to understand. And look what they say in verse 1. Verse 1, they say, make us a God who will go before us. Remember, Yahweh used to go before them in a cloud and as fire. But now he's just been up there on the mountain. He's not leading them anywhere, it seems. And what they're essentially trying to do is pull Yahweh down from that mountain, put him in a physical form so that they can carry him with them wherever they go. They want Yahweh to be who they want Yahweh to be, because the real Yahweh isn't doing for them what they want him to do. And that's the heart of idolatry. We may not be crafting golden calves, but anytime we put God in a little box that is more manageable for us because God's not serving us the way we want, that is idolatry. I mean, so many shapes and forms of that. When people say, I can't serve a God who sends people to hell, that's idolatry. Because you're saying, look, the God that I built over here, he says there is no hell. Or when people say Jesus is fine with denominations and he'll just save you no matter what you believe, that is idolatry. Anytime we worship a version of Jesus or Yahweh different from the real Jesus and the real Yahweh revealed in Scripture, we're building a golden calf, essentially. But I want you to see these key points here. First of all, they're using this golden calf as their own version of the tabernacle. In their minds, this calf is the physical representation of God's presence with them. But ironically, while they're building this calf, Moses is up on Mount Sinai getting instructions for the real physical representation of God's presence with them, which is the tabernacle. So I think that's probably partly why this comes right after the tabernacle section in 25 through 31. Also, what materials did they use to make this calf? Their gold earrings. Where did they get those earrings? Yeah, from the Egyptians. And what does that ultimately mean, where they got them from? God. God gave them to them because he allowed them to plunder the Egyptians. So they took the blessings of God and used them to commit evil. And interestingly, this is also connected to the tabernacle section, because in Exodus 25:3, God tells Moses, make sure that the people take up a freewill offering of gold and silver and bronze. Why? Because the tabernacle was going to be overlaid with gold. And so the word gold is used over 30 times in chapters 25 to 31, because there was going to be so much gold overlaying the tabernacle. And I think that's part of the implication. God blessed them with this jewelry, this gold coming out of Egypt, so that they could use it in service to him. But here, they're using that gold to take up a freewill contribution to violate the second commandment of God. And I want you to see the connection with chapter 24. That's why I had us read these two together. In that chapter, Moses built an altar to Yahweh, and they offered burnt offerings and peace offerings on it. Then they had a feast. Here they're doing all the same things. But in this case, rather than every act being a part of ratifying their covenant with Yahweh, every act here is destroying their covenant with Yahweh. And to make it worse, the idea of rising up to play is probably talking about sexual immorality. In the pagan world, they viewed gods as fertility gods. And so you would engage in fornication to entice the gods to send rain upon the earth. Well, doesn't it make sense? If you're the Israelites living in the desert, you're going to want this fertility god to send you rain and to take care of you? It's so sad. Back in Exodus 5:1, Moses said to Pharaoh, let my people go so that they may celebrate a feast to me in the wilderness. I think that's the feast that he had in mind, chapter 32. No. Which is why it ends in such an ominous way. You know, so many times God has said, these are my people. Let my people go. These are my own special possession. And here in verse 7, he tells Moses, go down at once, for your people, whom you brought up from the land of Egypt, have corrupted themselves. These are your people, not mine. Kind of like when a child does something horrible and your parents furious about it, and you say to your spouse, you won't believe what your son did in school today, right? But of course, magnify that by like a million, Because this isn't just a small violation. It's so serious, God says, I'm going to wipe all of them out and start over with you, Moses. And I'm sorry that took way too long, and Jason's going to have to ring the bell. But that's a good cliffhanger for Sunday. Thank you all so much.